Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Charles Kernighan of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, who examines the international garment industry's role in the working conditions that led to the deadly factory building collapse in Bangladesh. Elizabeth Nash, State Issues Manager with the Guttmacher Institute, who discusses the success of anti-abortion activists in passing dozens of new laws restricting women's reproductive rights in state legislatures across the U.S. And Alka Pradhan, counsel with the Constitution Project, who talks about the findings of a bipartisan panel investigating torture of post-9/11 U.S.-held detainees. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, allied with the Muslim Brotherhood, is facing pressure to reduce domestic food subsidies in order to win a $4.8 billion loan from the International Monetary Fund. But massive cuts in food and fuel subsidies could unravel Morsi's regime. In 1977, the IMF succeeded in pushing Egypt to cut food subsidies, but days of rioting forced then-President Anwar Sadat to reinstate the subsidies. In recent months, inflation has worsened to the point where many Egyptians now spend half their income on food. Food vendor Hamid Mohammed told the Los Angeles Times, "You get up at 5 a.m. to stand in line to feed your kids. This is what Egypt has become." 3 months after Cuban President Raul Castro eased restrictions on Cubans traveling abroad, the Miami Herald reports that an increasing number of Cubans are obtaining travel visas to visit the United States or going through countries such as Mexico to make their way to America. Cubans are also traveling to Haiti or Nigeria in hopes of using alternative routes into the United States, where over 1.6 million Cubans have legal permanent residency. The U.S. Interest Section in Havana has approved a growing number of tourist visas to the United States, as hundreds of Cubans line up each day to file applications. But American immigration authorities fear Cuban families will attempt to stay in the United States once their travel visas expire. Since October 31st, more than 7,000 Cubans have entered Mexico with the intention of traveling to the U.S. At the current rate, over 13,000 Cubans will enter Mexico in 2013, a third more than entered Mexico in 2011. Under the U.S. wet-foot, dry-foot policy, undocumented Cubans who are picked up at sea are returned to Cuba, while those who reach dry land in U.S. territory win a chance to remain in the United States and later qualify for expedited legal permanent resident status and eventually U.S. citizenship. The massive explosion at the West Texas fertilizer plant on April 17th killed 15 people, most of them firefighters or rescue workers. The disaster also exposed a regulatory black hole around plant safety. The fertilizer factory stored 270 tons of ammonium nitrate, the material Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the Oklahoma City Federal Building in 1995. Today, ammonium nitrate is popular with farmers who use it as an effective fertilizer for crops, but it is highly volatile and can explode if not properly handled. So far, investigators have not declared the cause of the explosion at the fertilizer plant south of Dallas. Various federal and state agencies had jurisdiction over the plant, but no agency appears to have been in charge. The last federal inspection at the plant conducted by OSHA took place in 1985. Plant managers also failed to notify the Department of Homeland Security about the size of its stockpile of ammonium nitrate. Moreover, different federal agencies have varying standards in regulating ammonium nitrate. According to Mother Jones magazine, the Environmental Protection Agency classifies anhydrous ammonia as toxic but not flammable. But OSHA considers it flammable, as do the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. After last week's explosion, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality said it completed 7 inspections at the West Texas plant since 2002. The last inspection occurred in 2007 in response to an odor complaint. Many independent safety experts say an explosion involving ammonium nitrate was predictable and could have been prevented by adhering to strict safety standards. In 1947, over 580 people were killed in Texas City in an explosion involving ammonium nitrate. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Five days after the April 24th collapse of Rana Plaza, an illegally constructed eight-story building that housed five garment factories in a shopping mall in Dhaka, Bangladesh, government officials suspended rescue efforts. While nearly 400 bodies have been pulled from the rubble, an estimated 1,000 people who were inside the building at the time of the collapse are still missing, which could bring the death toll to near 1,400. Despite cracks in the walls and warnings made to the building's owner about the danger, employees of the garment factories were ordered to report for work on the day of the collapse. Reacting to what many observers believe will be the garment industry's deadliest accident, and a string of other disasters, including a November 2012 fire in another Bangladeshi factory that killed 112, garment workers have staged militant protests in the capital city, smashing cars and setting fire to two clothing factories. International companies that made their apparel in the collapsed factories included Dress Barn, Primark, Joe Fresh, Benetton, and The Children's Place. Your reporter spoke with Charles Kernighan, director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights, who examines the role multinational apparel corporations play in the poor working conditions in sweatshops across the developing world, which contributed to the tragic loss of life in the Bangladeshi building collapse.
This building had a permit for five stories, but they built three additional stories, which were completely illegal, and it was shoddy work. And there, we don't even know how many workers really worked in the factory. It could be even 4,000, could be 3,000. All we know is that right now, in this factory collapse in Bangladesh, 400 workers are dead. 2,437 workers have been accounted for. Of that, 650 are seriously injured and hospitalized. Many have amputees. The police are still saying that 1,000 workers are unaccounted for or missing. So the death toll could soar. I mean, we could be talking about 1,000 people dead or even above that. And this really is the worst manufacturing disaster in the history of the garment industry. So this is just brutal. And these young people, 80% of them young women, they'll work 14 and a half hours a day. They'll do this for 6 days, 6 and 7 days, mostly 7 days, and they get 2 days off a month. So you're talking about young women who are in the factory 90 to 100 hours a week. That's standard. It's a hell of life. And their wages are pitiful. They get helpers, the younger people get 12 cents an hour. So-called junior sewers, they get 22 cents an hour. Senior workers get 26 cents an hour. You're talking about the lowest wages in the world. So here you've got a death trap, which was illegally built. You have five garment factories inside this building, and when the workers saw the cracks on the walls of the building, this was on Tuesday of April 23rd, when they saw the cracks, literally cracks in the walls of the factory, they refused to go to work. They came back on the following day, Wednesday, April 24th, and you know the workers were sort of milling around outside to see what was going to happen. And the bosses came over and said to them, if you don't go to work, you're not going to get paid for the entire month of April. And, of course, these workers are so poor, they live from hand to mouth. They can't give up a month's wages. And on top of that, there were gang members there with sticks and clubs that were ready to beat the young women to smithereens if they didn't go into the factory. So they were forced to go into the factory. 1 hour later, the building imploded and pancaked down. There's no way to condone this. This is just vicious, cruel. They treat these workers like they're slaves. And the garment owners, all they want is the cheapest garment possible. So for them, you know, Bangladesh is a bonanza.
Charles, I've heard it said that this building collapse in Bangladesh, compared often to the Triangle New York City shirtwaist factory back in 1911, where mostly women, 146 of them killed, many of them having to jump to their deaths from a clothing factory and building right in downtown New York City. As that was a turning point in the American labor movement, that this may be a similar turning point in Bangladesh and maybe for other sweatshops around the world. If that's true, do you place your faith in change in people on the ground in each country in terms of strong unions developing or being allowed to develop? Or are we looking at some other kind of international treaties, the International Labor Organization, or other institutions that can play a positive role here in changing the conditions in these factories?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I mean, it's a huge question. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in 1911, that mobilized the American people. We didn't have industrial relations before that. It was only after those women died and leapt from the top of the Ash Building in Greenwich Village, it was only then that we had an industrial policy. It was only then that the laws were implemented, that there'd be sprinkler systems and exit doors had to open outward. They couldn't be locked. And hearings after hearings were held so that between 1911 and 1938, for example, there were no sweatshops in the United States. They were wiped out completely because they were governed by laws. If the American people were more engaged, I mean, that would be very powerful, but I don't really sense it or see it. So I think we're at a crossroads right now where we better get our U.S. government involved and the European Union involved and the Canadians involved. I think this is the time when we really make some challenges, and central to it is that workers have to have health and safety, and they have to have the right to organize.
That was Charles Kernighan, director of the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights. Find links to more news and commentary on the relationship between Western-owned manufacturers and sweatshop conditions across the developing world on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past few months, many states controlled by Republican governors and legislatures seem to be in a race to see who can craft the most restrictive abortion laws. The winner as of now is North Dakota, which passed a law limiting abortions to the first 6 weeks of pregnancy. So far, 10 states have passed bans after 20 weeks, 7 have gone into effect, while 3, in Georgia, Idaho, and Arizona, are being challenged in federal court. Meanwhile, 26 states have passed laws imposing new restrictive building code standards specifically targeting abortion clinics, most of which are not related to patient care. And 4 states have recently adopted legislation requiring that abortion providers have admitting privileges at local hospitals. That law in Mississippi, if it goes into effect, would result in the closing of the state's only abortion clinic because doctors currently travel from out of state to perform abortions. After Kansas Republican Governor Sam Brownback signed a new anti-abortion law that declares life begins at conception, blocks tax breaks for abortion providers, and requires doctors to falsely warn patients that abortion can cause breast cancer, New York and Washington State are moving to ease restrictions with some abortion procedures. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Elizabeth Nash, State Issues Manager with the Guttmacher Institute's Washington, D.C. office. Here she discusses the success anti-abortion activists have had in passing dozens of new laws restricting women's reproductive rights in state legislatures across the U.S.
The action around abortion restrictions and bans has really escalated since the 2010 elections. And this year, I wouldn't say so much that the volume has gone up, but certainly the extreme nature of these restrictions has shown up in the sense that we are now talking about bans instead of burdensome restrictions. And I think what makes this 2.5-3 year wave so interesting and so harmful is that the kinds of restrictions that we started seeing in the 80s and into the 90s, the waiting periods and the counseling requirements and parental involvement requirements, those kinds of restrictions, for the most part, have fallen by the wayside, and now we're seeing much more burdensome restrictions become law. I mean, in some ways it's the same old, but for example, a waiting period that gets passed now is a 72-hour waiting period rather than a 24-hour waiting period. And now, this year, we are starting to see some very aggressive abortion bans. We've seen the North Dakota bill become law, and that bans abortion at 6 weeks of pregnancy. In Arkansas, we saw a ban at 12 weeks of pregnancy. And these bills are just incredibly extreme and very harmful for women's health. Women will not be able to access abortions in North Dakota should that law go into effect.
Many people, including some abortion foes, are saying these new laws would never pass constitutional muster because of the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade. What do you think about the legality of these new laws, and do you think any of them would survive a constitutional challenge?
What the Supreme Court has said is that abortion may be legal up until viability. The state cannot ban abortion before that point. And then after viability, a state may limit access to abortion but must include protections for the woman's life and health. And by viability, we mean when a doctor determines that a fetus can survive outside the womb, and that can be with some medical assistance, but it really is how far along the fetus is developed so that it really can withstand, it can survive outside the womb.
Elizabeth Nash, I heard an interview with the North Dakota legislator who spearheaded the passage of the extremely restrictive bill there, and she was saying that with all the medical advances in the past 40 years since Roe v. Wade was decided, the age of viability has shrunk so that younger fetuses can survive outside the womb. What do you think about that?
Viability in 1970 was considered around 26 weeks. Now we're looking at maybe 24, 25 weeks. So the difference isn't that much. There is a difference, but it isn't as big as some people make it out to be. And certainly we have had advances in medical science, but each pregnancy develops at a different rate, and each woman needs to be evaluated by a provider. That's why the Supreme Court did not say, oh, you can have an abortion up until 24 weeks. They picked viability specifically because each pregnancy develops at a different rate, and that seems to be a good demarcation of viability. So what we're seeing now and over the past couple of years are laws that would ban abortion at 20 weeks post-fertilization, which is before viability, and they have very limited exceptions that don't include what the U.S. Supreme Court meant by life and health. So we saw those for the past couple of years, and now this year we've seen this 12-week abortion ban in Arkansas and a 6-week abortion ban in North Dakota. Now, what we're seeing in the legal system are that some of these 20-week abortion bans are being challenged, and the Arkansas 12-week abortion ban has been challenged, and we're expecting a challenge in the 6-week abortion ban in North Dakota. And what that means is that we are going to have to wait for a couple of years to find out what the judges say and how these cases wind their way through the legal system. And so up until this year, people were really looking in Arizona, where there is a law that bans abortion before viability, and it is in the federal courts, and that was the law that everyone was looking at to be perhaps a challenge to Roe. Perhaps that would make it up to the Supreme Court. And now we have these earlier bans that are also going to make their way up through the legal system.
That was Elizabeth Nash, State Issues Manager with the Guttmacher Institute. For more analysis and commentary on the ongoing battle over reproductive rights, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just days before President Obama joined four former U.S. presidents to celebrate the opening of George W. Bush's presidential library on the campus of Southern Methodist University in Dallas, the Constitution Project released a report detailing the findings of a 2-year independent investigation into the abuse of U.S.-held detainees in the years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. The group's bipartisan 11-member task force on detainee treatment, which was led by two retired members of Congress, Republican Asa Hutchinson and Democrat James R. Jones, concluded that American intelligence and military personnel used interrogation techniques on suspected terrorists captured in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere that in many instances constituted torture. The 600-page report found that the kind of considered and detailed discussions that occurred after 9/11, directly involving a president and his top advisors on the wisdom, propriety, and legality of inflicting pain and torment on some detainees in our custody, was unique in America's history of military warfare. The report also concluded that information obtained from prisoners using torture and other abusive techniques produced no valuable information that could not have been obtained by other means. The task force found the treatment of prisoners in the custody of American military and CIA personnel or subjected to similar or worse abuses when transferred to third-party nations violated numerous U.S. laws in international treaties. Your reporter spoke with Anka Pradhan, who served as counsel to the Constitution Project's Task Force on Detainee Treatment during their 2-year investigation. Here she summarizes the panel's report, the disturbing lack of accountability for officials who ordered torture, and the task force recommendations for changes in U.S. policy.
What we primarily looked to in defining torture is, of course, the United Nations Convention Against Torture, which the United States helped draft, which we ratified in the 1980s, which we've really been a leader on. And the full definition of torture in the convention is any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession. That's the primary definition. There are secondary definitions that include punishing them for acts that they've committed or any reason based on discrimination. So that's the definition of torture under the convention. Now, acts falling short of that are considered cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. In working on this report, we looked at the specific techniques that were used by U.S. personnel in the theaters of war abroad and by the CIA in the secret prisons abroad, in addition to Guantanamo Bay. And it was very important for the task force to understand not only why there were assertions for torture, but really look at themselves in context. So, for instance, when you look at some of the techniques that were approved for use on detainees as so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, one of them was a sleep deprivation technique. Now, the sleep deprivation, for example, was used by the CIA on certain detainees in freezing temperatures for days at a time, up to a week at a time, while the detainee was shackled with his hands behind his back and in adult diapers, because allowing him to use the restroom was considered to interfere with use of the technique. So that, for instance, the task force found was clearly torture.
One other very important issue that a lot of people are concerned about through the years of the revelations of U.S. torture of our detainees in the post-9/11 era is accountability for those who ordered these illegal activities. What is it that your report has stated about your views on accountability? When President Obama came into office, he famously said we want to look forward and not backward, and therefore accountability seemed to be, and in actuality, has been off the table. Any of these former officials in the George W. Bush administration have not, for the most part, been held to account.
As a preliminary matter, the task force did not approach this as a group of prosecutors. You know, as we stated, we didn't have access to all of the classified information. We certainly didn't have subpoena power. But in terms of accountability, you know, certainly the task force found that the highest officials in the Bush administration were held at least moral responsibility and ethical responsibility for the imposition of these techniques, of these torture and cruel and human degrading treatment techniques on detainees in theaters of war abroad. And there is a very real concern that there has been no accountability, no calling to account, no investigation even into what occurred. The Convention Against Torture and many other conventions legally obligate us to at least investigate fully any allegations of torture or cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, and that has not occurred. What has occurred are certain indictments or investigations abroad that we detail in the report, indictments of former officials, indictments of military, indictments of CIA officials, and we also look at the fact that the United States, unfortunately, has, in many cases, done its best to stifle those investigations. So there's not only a concern that we are not looking at this at home, but there's a very real concern that we are preventing other countries from doing so, including many of our former allies or current allies who are under fire abroad for participating in this program.
In your report, you conclude by recommending several policy changes here in the United States. Can you summarize them?
Absolutely. There are several very important ones. One of the important ones is, for instance, the declassification of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee report and general declassification of many of the reports and opinions that have been conducted by the government, by the Bush administration, and perhaps by the Obama administration on this topic, because the American public deserves to know what was done in their name, especially 10, 11, 12 years on. That's one of the important ones. Then there are a whole host of recommendations on what the United States needs to do in a concert with its allies in terms of obtaining diplomatic assurances or use of diplomatic assurances for suspects who we want to send abroad or former detainees who we want to release abroad, who were concerned maybe tortured abroad, in terms of how we should release detainees abroad with a certain set of regulations as to how they're going to be reintroduced into society to combat recidivism, in terms of how we should calculate recidivism, because the task force found many problems with how those numbers are currently being calculated. So those recommendations really cover a wide swath of topics. This really is, if I may say so, the task force report is the most holistic look at detainee treatment to date, and I would really urge everyone to look at it and read as much of it as possible.
That was Akka Pradhan, counsel to the Constitution Project's Bipartisan Task Force on Detainee Treatment. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you'll find links to download a copy of the task force report and find related news and commentary. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.